The coroner has spoken in the Gabby Petito case, and her cause of death, painful to hear, strangulation and throttling. But what the coroner let slip has a lot of people talking without even uttering Brian Laundrie's name. And later, they have scoured the swamp and they've checked out tips on the Appalachian Trail. But Brian Laundrie could literally be anywhere, anywhere in the world. Tonight, three of the world's top experts go global on how to hunt down Brian Laundrie. They are live here on Banfield.
After a detailed investigation by our forensic pathologists, our anthropologists, and local law enforcement, with assistance from the FBI, the Teton County Coroner Office is filing the following verdict in the death of Gabrielle Lenora Petito. We hereby find the cause and manner of death to be the cause death by strangulation and manner is homicide.
That was Dr. Brent Blue, the Teton County Coroner, just hours ago, in fact, confirming what, honestly, many of us, we already suspected, that Gabby Petito was almost certainly murdered. Dr. Blue gave a very short explanation of his findings during today's press conference, answering very few questions, in fact. But what he said about Gabby's final moments with her fiancé could spell big trouble for Brian Laundrie. As always, I am joined by News Nation's Brian Enten from his stakeout position outside of the Laundrie family home, where this case just got a whole lot more serious and their need for specialized lawyers a lot more pressing. Brian, my first question to you involves the time and the date of death. It was the number one question for the coroner today. Explain why that particular question is so significant in the case.
It's significant because we now have an idea of when Gabby Petito was killed. For the first time, we got this information from the coroner. He said that they believe they found the body about 3 to 4 weeks after Gabby Petito was killed, which we now know she died of strangulation. Listen to what the coroner said.
I am curious if any DNA samples were taken from Gabby's remains, and also if the body was intact. Are you able to tell us the condition of Gabby's remains?
I can tell you the DNA samples were taken by law enforcement, and all I can tell you about remains is that the body was outside for 3 to 4 weeks.
So interesting, we now know DNA samples were taken. We obviously suspected that. We assumed that the FBI wanted DNA samples, especially after they were here at the house in the camper taking DNA samples that we assume were from Brian Laundrie. And also, we now know that 3 to 4 week element. Ashley?
Okay, Brian, two things that are so critical about what the coroner just said. That first part about the DNA, and this is going to be not what a lot of people expect, but that DNA issue, make note of it, lock it away, because it could be huge and in a good way for Brian Laundrie. I know that doesn't sound right, but I'm going to explain that in the coming moments in this program, why the DNA sample could be a good thing for Brian Laundrie. In the meantime, though, Brian, that timeline, the time of death, you know, for weeks we've been talking about this timeline with all of the people on social media, and what the coroner said today, 3 to 4 weeks that she'd been there before they discovered her body, it actually fits into the timeline in an extraordinary way. So let me just go right to it. Let's start with August 22nd. This is the earliest that she could have died, according to the coroner. It's 4 weeks before she's found exactly. But if you go to August 24th, Gabby and Brian are actually seen checking out of a Salt Lake hotel together. So she's alive on the 24th. And on the next day, Gabby has her final FaceTime with her mother and says that they're in Grand Teton National Park. So on the 25th, again, she is alive. So you can knock out the first part of that timeline of 4 weeks. At least you can truncate it by about 3 to 4 days. On the 26th of August, Brian is spotted alone with the white van at the Spread Creek campground by that TikToker named Jessica Schultz, also known as Jessica Over Yonder. That's on the 26th. On the 27th, and focus on this day, A witness account says Brian and Gabby are seen arguing at a restaurant in Jackson. So she could very well be alive on this day if that restaurant episode is accurate. 27th, she could be alive. So you can now knock out more than just a couple of days. You can knock out almost the better part of the first week, right? Now go to that next little part. A YouTuber sees the van parked at the Spread Creek campground. That's the Red, White, and Bethune YouTuber. There's no one inside the van at that point. And the other really curious thing on the 27th, Gabby's mom gets that weird text, "Can you help Stan?" from Gabby's phone. Well, Stan's her grandfather, and Gabby never calls him Stan. She calls him Grandpa. So that does not sound like it's Gabby talking. That's why the 27th is so important. Now go to the 29th. This is 3 weeks to the day before Gabby's body is found. Okay, so we're narrowing this timeline now. This is the latest date that she could have died. And another TikToker named Miranda Baker was driving in the area, says she picked up Brian Laundrie. He's hitchhiking away from the campsite and suddenly freaks out, wants to get out of the vehicle. Still on that same day, a second driver, Norma Jean Jalovich, she's on her way to church. She picks up what she thinks is Brian Laundrie, and he's hitchhiking back towards the campsite. First one's picking him up, going away from the campsite. Second one's going back to the campsite. She drops him at the entrance to the campground, but it's a miles-long dirt road. He doesn't want her to go down that dirt road, curiously, says he'll rather walk. Now to August 30th, Gabby's mom gets that other bizarre text saying no service in Yosemite. Yeah, they never got to Yosemite, so that's not true. Then, August 31st, Brian's mom changes the family camping trip reservation. The camping trip in Florida takes it from 2 people to 3, but not 4 people, because eventually Brian would join them without that fiancé of his, Gabby Petito, that travel mate that he's with. Nope. Roberta Laundrie doesn't change the reservation to 4 people, just to 3 people. And then we all know on September 1st, that license plate reader saw that van coming back into Florida. So, Brian, the question I have for you is, when you fit what the coroner said today into that timeline, the 27th of August is looking a lot less like a theory and a lot more like the day that Gabby actually died.
Yeah, to hear you lay all of that out, Ashley, it certainly seems to make sense. And what I've been doing since we got this new information from the coroner today is trying to piece together what we've seen out here at the house in regards to the last month in combination with this new timeline and what we're hearing from the coroner. And one thing I thought of today, you remember that day several weeks ago when we saw the FBI show up in the morning. They were here about 10 minutes, went right into the back of this camper, had that little vial, took something from inside the camper and then left. And then we later found from the Laundrie family attorney that they were here getting something that belonged to Brian for DNA. Well, that all now fits into this perfectly now that the coroner confirmed today that the FBI did take DNA off of Gabby's body.
Yeah. Okay. So another thing, when we were on the call together, Brian, with a lot of other reporters around the country, and I dare say around the world, it was Daily Mail reporters as well, maybe based in New York, but that's a global publication. And I wanted to find out from the coroner, how hard was that cause of death to determine? Like, did you know right away when you retrieved your body, or was this a long drawn out process that you had to investigate? Meaning it wasn't just you were trying to prove what you thought off the bat. You didn't know off the bat. And so I had that question. I'm not sure how it looks, but it looked very strange on the Zoom. There would be a black screen with names that popped up while we were asking questions. But this is how that went when I asked that question of the coroner. Take a look.
Can I ask you if from the very beginning of your process, was it obvious that the cause, not the manner, that the cause was strangulation and that you just needed this time to prove it out? Or were you completely unaware from the beginning what the cause of death was for Gabby Petito and had to resolve through a number of puzzle-solving manners and other experts to arrive at that final cause determination?
In a situation like this, nothing is obvious. And so the cause of death required investigation.
So, Brian, that was clear that, you know, they had work to do and it wasn't something that they knew right away. This was something that took a lot of work. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But what was so weird is that you and your producer, as you were watching this press conference via Zoom, you got a text. You got a bizarre text. And meantime, Gabby's family is putting out a statement. This is what Gabby's family is saying in a statement. Gabby's family is not making any statements until they bring Gabby home. I will let you know when that happens. That's from Richard Stafford, their attorney. And yet you're getting a text from the laundry representative. What on earth were they texting during this particular news conference about Gabby's cause of death?
So this was from the laundry family attorney, Mr. Bertolino. Normally, he just texts us when we ask questions. So this text did sort of surprise us that it came in unsolicited. But right at the end of the press conference, he texted us and he said, Gabby Petito's death at such a young age is a tragedy. While Brian Laundry is currently charged with the unauthorized use of a debit card belonging to Gabby, Brian is only considered a person of interest in relation to Gabby Petito's demise. At this time, Brian is still missing, and when he is located, we will address the pending fraud charge against him. So an unsolicited text by Mr. Bertolino. What was interesting is after he sent that text and we put it out on Twitter, Gabby's mom responded on Twitter by basically saying that that was garbage.
Well, it's certainly tone deaf. I mean, honestly, why would you enter into the fray at a time that is just so devastating for all of those people who loved Gabby, not even knowing her and loved her? It just seems odd. Listen, there's another thing that I think you and I both noticed together, and it was this little moment that I don't know if the coroner intended for this to happen, but it sure is a serious question. And that is, he let slip the term domestic violence while he was talking about, you know, the issues of Gabby's death and how he came to his determination. I thought that was very, I think it stood out. Did you feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. It was the first thing where I thought, I think he may have said something he did not mean to say, the coroner, because he was so guarded throughout this entire press conference, basically saying he couldn't answer questions. He wasn't going to talk about the investigation. He really only gave the two pieces of information, the cause of death and how long he thinks the body was there. Everything else, he sort of tried to say, I can't talk about it. But then when someone asked him, you know, what do you think about the media and the circus? That's when he sort of alluded to domestic violence, which was a very, very interesting moment.
That was quite the media circus, and continues to be. Unfortunately, this is only one of many deaths around the country of people who are involved in domestic violence. And it's unfortunate that these other deaths do not get as much coverage as this one. I'm assuming that because the deceased was a blogger, that this received more coverage than others, but there are a lot of both men and women who have lost their lives that aren't covered with this kind of media attention.
So you heard that. Deaths of people who are involved in domestic violence. He made the connection there. You know, read into it as you want, but he made that connection.
I'm still trying to figure out if he let it slip that this was a domestic violence incident, as he's been discussing with police his findings, or if he's just thinking back to the incident with the body cam where he knows there was domestic violence between this couple and this poor young woman would be dead just a few weeks later. All right, Brian, just because he brought up domestic violence, we checked the criminal code in Wyoming because we want to know exactly what it pertains to. And I think it's important for our viewers to know. And so here's what we found. It's a person commits an assault or battery against a member of the same household. And a member of the same household has a definition as well. It's any of these: a current or former spouse of the accused, an adult with whom the alleged offender resides or previously resided, a parent or adult child of the alleged offender, a person with whom the alleged offender has a child, or, check this last one, a person whom the alleged offender is dating or has previously dated. They also live together. So it's if the coroner was referring to this incident and connecting domestic violence to this incident, not to the body cam incident, there is only one person on the list that really fits this description who could have done this to her, isn't there?
Yes. And again, that is where this connection was very, very interesting and why I texted you this afternoon the minute I heard that, because I was like, this is, he didn't mean to say this, but when he connected the domestic violence to Gabby Petito and the autopsy, he's obviously now bringing Brian Laundrie into the situation, whereas before that, he was continually saying, I won't talk about Brian Laundrie, I won't talk about Brian Laundrie. But if you're going to talk about domestic violence involving Gabby Petito, obviously you're now bringing Brian Laundrie into the conversation.
Yet again, the puzzle pieces are coming together slowly, whether it's on television programs or on the internet or in Facebook groups with all the people who've been looking at the clues. I don't think they're so far off from a lot of their thinking. Brian Enten, as usual, just terrific reporting out there. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Ashley.
We're going to dig deeper into that domestic violence claim by the coroner. And oh, yeah, that little DNA nugget that I mentioned. How on earth could that actually help Brian Laundrie? You're going to be very surprised by it, and you're going to find out after this. Welcome back. The news today was earth-shattering for the Petito family. Their daughter, they learned, who seemed so full of life, met a very violent death. Someone, the Teton County coroner says, killed her by strangulation and throttling. But that coroner let slip a few clues that just might narrow down who that someone is, all at the same time as a nationwide manhunt is on for Brian Laundrie, albeit for bank fraud, for now. I'm joined by two people who know how to read between the lines when it comes to building a case. Mary Fulginiti is a former prosecutor, and Joseph Scott Morgan is a certified death investigator. He is also the Distinguished Scholar of Applied Science at Jacksonville State University and hosts the podcast Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan. Welcome to both of you. Mary, I'm going to begin with you if I can. Strangulation and throttling. How often does that actually end up not being murder? How often is it actually accidental?
Yeah, no, in this case, you know, it's a confirmed homicide, and manual strangulation and throttling is using your hands to physically kill someone. It's a brutal and violent crime, and it's definitely intentional, which would equal murder.
I can only think of other cases, though. I mean, the preppy murderer, Robert Chambers, said it was rough sex. He had a defense. He did that. It was strangulation, too. Is that the kind of thing that can be invoked in a case like this?
You know, that is, there are cases where people do have rough sex and where they utilize strangulation, and that would definitely lower it on in terms of what the potential crime would be. But here, I think given all the evidence and given what we have with the timeline so far and given the violent behavior that we've seen exposed, you know, from Brian Laundrie, that I think they're looking at this more like a crime of passion, which we also see with strangulation. And in those circumstances, sadly, it's typically between people who know each other and typically usually an intentional act.
So, Joe, I wanted to ask you about the comments from the coroner today. I was so interested to find out how they got to cause of death. And I'm thinking ahead to trial, right? I'm thinking, what can a defense attorney use? What can they exploit from what the coroner's finding? And I just want to play this one soundbite where the coroner talks about just how much, you know, ammo they had to bring in to the autopsy to try to get to that final determination of the cause of death. Have a look.
This autopsy included a whole body CAT scan, an examination by a forensic pathologist, an examination by a forensic anthropologist, and toxicology evaluation. So we pretty much covered all the bases.
So, Joe, the question I have, he left out one that he added later, and that was an entomologist that was brought in. That's the study of bugs, often, you know, used to determine the time of death. The question I have is, if you have to bring in all those experts and put together a puzzle over the course of weeks and weeks, how ironclad is that cause of death? How much can that be exploited by, say, a defense attorney down the road?
I don't know about a defense attorney, but I can tell you they've covered all of their bases. Ash, I cannot tell you the last time I remember a coroner slash forensic pathologist mentioning the term CAT scan relative to a postmortem examination. They've taken this from the 2D world into the 3D world. And you know, I take exception with people that were casting aspersions on this little burg out there in nowhere. They brought in a CAT scan in order to do this. Everything was self-contained. They have covered all of their bases. They have done a fantastic job at this point, and they're going to continue to withhold information or just release what they want to. This guy is still out there. He's still on the run. They're not going to show their hand to anybody. But right now, I'm amazed at the job they've done.
So, Mary, I was thinking about the DNA, right? When they said we took a DNA sample mm-hmm. from the body, all I could think of was, well, my God, how's that going to be helpful? I mean, they lived in a van together. Of course, Brian's DNA should be expected to be all over the body, even if they hadn't seen each other in days. The van is just ripe with both of their DNA. And then I thought of this. What if someone else's DNA is found? Right. All of a sudden, that changes the dynamic if Brian ends up charged in this case.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if they find foreign body DNA or somebody else's DNA, it's obviously going to be, for Brian anyways, a sigh of relief in some ways and something that will be obviously further investigated and exploited by the defense. But when you look at this case and you see the autopsy report, which what little we have of it shows what happened to her, sadly, and we know that it's, you know, in manipulation and strangulation. We know when it happened 3 to 4 weeks out, which puts him right or her with him right about the time of the killing. And now you have to figure out, well, who has the motivation to strangle a woman in the middle of the Grand Tetons? And when you look at that and you think about that, you're thinking about who's angry, who's mad, who's in a fight, what's happening in her world then, you know, that would cause some stranger to actually commit this act. And I have to tell you, it looks really bad for Brian Laundry. And plus, he fled the crime. And fleeing, you know, the scene is considered consciousness of guilt because it's obviously not an act that an innocent person would do. An innocent person would help, go to the police, do something that would be, or at least cooperate with the police. And in this situation, he didn't. He fled, he went home, he lawyered up, and he didn't help at all.
So, guys, if you could hold that thought for a moment, when I come back after the break, I have a very pressing question about what the coroner said, because all of us, you know, we've now seen the pictures out, you know, in the camping area of the memorial that was laid by Gabby's stepdad. The stone cross and the flowers is just heartbreaking to look at that, knowing now what the coroner, you know, told us about 3 to 4 weeks that the body was there before being discovered, all the while everybody being silent in the Laundry family. But more importantly, the question that was asked, was Gabby buried or was Gabby above ground? When we come back after the break, I want to ask you why that is such an important question and why the answer was so curious. That's next. Welcome back, everyone. Still with me, former federal prosecutor Mary Fulginiti and certified death investigator Joseph Scott Morgan. He's the host of the podcast Body Bags with Joe Morgan, Joseph Scott Morgan. So, Joe, I want to start with you this block, and that is this question that the coroner would not say whether Gabby Petito was found buried or not buried. And I'm wondering if there's a significance there and why he wouldn't just say that.
You know, I think that he's playing this close to the vest, and also this goes to, I think, typing the individual that did this. When you think about somebody burying an individual, particularly in this case, after a homicide is committed, even the most base person many times will conduct a burial. It goes to memorializing the dead. It paints a completely different picture. When you talk about somebody that essentially takes a body and discards that body, like Gabby's, like they didn't matter, just leaves them on top of the ground. And right now, indications are, particularly from drone footage, is that might be what has happened. That turns us in a completely different direction as far as I'm concerned.
That's fascinating. Mary, there was a great question for the coroner about other injuries that might be healing on Gabby. The coroner would not discuss it, but that's significant. That's the kind of thing you would find out about a trial.
Yeah, and they're going to definitely have scoured the body for all other types of injuries on her, you know, especially, and for, like we had previously discussed, DNA under her fingernails, anything that you'd call defensive wounds to see if she was trying to fight back, because that's going to be very important when it comes to, you know, what happened here, how did it happen, and who ultimately, you know, has the motivation and to do it.
So So, Joe, just bounce off what Mary just said about, you know, what's under her fingernails. Every autopsy looks at what's under her fingernails. But when you're with a domestic partner, you might just have that DNA under your fingernails. It might not be helpful.
I think that it's significant here, and this is why. This isn't just common sharing of DNA material, like in a passive form. This is someone trying to protect themselves. They will have done what are referred to as nail scrapings and nail clippings. The FBI response team, the evidence response team, I can almost guarantee you, took those clippings with them. They're being analyzed. This gives us an idea that if she fought back, her hands have literally scraped his face or scraped his neck. That gives you an idea that there was a violent physical contact. If that skin is rolled beneath the nails, that's not passive. That's something that has happened in a dynamic environment, and a lot can be read into that, particularly by the prosecution. If that's his skin, I think that that's going to be a huge nail in his coffin.
So that also leads me, Mary, to say, why on earth didn't they do something in Florida sooner when they had an opportunity to see if somebody had healing scratches and to check for, you know, these kinds of wounds that might have been inflicted in the effort to defend herself?
You know, I think at the time, you know, they did ask to speak with him, and he hired a lawyer right off the bat. And once you hire a lawyer, you don't have to talk to anyone. And he refused to talk and refused to cooperate. And that's his legal right. So at that point, they couldn't do anything. They didn't have the legal right to. And he was considered only a person of interest, which he is now. But that doesn't necessarily change that, you know, he didn't have to talk to them, and they couldn't force him.
I hear you, and that totally makes sense to me. We have a Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate ourselves, but not to be scarce. I mean, we don't have the right to not have eyes on us, for heaven's sake. That's something different.
Well, they could have asked to photograph him, and they could have asked to do a number of different things, you're right, to see if there was some sort of altercation.
Him, you know?
Right. But they didn't, and I think it's just because she was, you know, I think as cases are dynamic and situations are obviously ever-changing, I think the focus really started to be on finding her, and then he fled, obviously, shortly thereafter. But, you know, I think there's no question in my mind that the feds are looking at him as a subject right now, as a target. They might just say a person of interest, but he's definitely the person that they're focused on, and they're just trying to gather all the evidence and information that they possibly can before they ultimately, you know, pursue him in that capacity.
Yeah, I just I smell a charge coming, and I feel like it's not long off. There's a lot of probable cause here. There is a lot of evidence already. And there is what you said, consciousness of guilt in the flight. Hey, Joseph Scott Morgan, Mary Fulgeniti, I hope you will come back again. This has been really enlightening. I do appreciate it. Thank you to the both of you.
Thank you.
So if you are still among the millions wondering where in the world is Brian Laundry, you are asking exactly the right question.
I say, now with all the chaos at the border, I caught 45 guys in Mexico. They drove them north over the panhandle, wherever they, you know, a little trip across Louisiana and Alabama, first then Louisiana. With all the chaos on the border, he could have walked with a monkey suit on across.
Sure, it could be Mexico, as John Walsh speculates. It could be as far as Morocco. Up next, three guys you really don't want on your tail, no matter where in the world you may be hiding. Welcome back. You have heard that time is money, right? Well, forget it. When it comes to manhunts, time is distance. And one reason that we all keep saying Brian Laundry could be anywhere is that he's had ample time to get there. He's only been a fugitive, technically, since that arrest warrant came out back on September 22nd for allegedly using Gabby Petito's debit card. Before that, he could have gone anywhere he liked, in this country or other countries, without even glancing over his shoulder, because nobody was even looking for him back then. Laundry's parents claim that he drove off to the swamp for a day hike back on September 13th, which was 4 days before they actually happened to mention it to police that he was missing. And it was 9 days before the warrant for his arrest. If he did go abroad, he joins a veritable rogues gallery of fugitives who followed the same impulse, but who, with rare exception, would end up right back in the jurisdiction that they fled. So feast your eyes on those guys. They didn't do so well. I'm going to talk about a few of those famous cases and how they apply or not to the laundry manhunt with some of the leaders in their field. Joel Lambert, I don't have to tell you, has helped us to understand just what it takes to survive as a wanted person wherever in the world you may be. He is a former Navy SEAL. He's the host of Lone Target on Discovery Channel, and he's just really unbelievably badass. John Cuff is the former head of the Northeast Fugitive Investigation Division of the U.S. Marshals Service. Did you know there's U.S. Marshals overseas? There are. And Chuck Jordan is president of both the International Bounty Hunter Union and the National Association of Fugitive Recovery Agents. Did you even know there were such organizations? There are. They're good. Welcome all to you. John Cuff, I'm going to begin to you. It's an easy question. How do we even know if Brian Laundrie has left the country?
Good evening, Ashley. Thank you for having me. That's the million-dollar question right now. We don't know if he's alive or dead, right? So whether, in fact, he left the country or not, that needs to be developed during the investigative process here. So as much as emphasis is being put on this manhunt down in the area of Florida there, there's also a parallel investigation going on looking at the digital grid, the electronics, family, friends, associates, things of that nature going back over the years. So that's really not transparent right now, right? So as part of that process, you're going to develop leads, right? And those leads, you got leads that are bringing you outside or what we call OCONUS, outside continental United States. At that point, we, in the Marshal Service, we would get our international branch involved. And they, in turn, would get Interpol involved, okay? And Interpol would direct the leads to the various countries. Now, having said that, if the countries are contiguous here to the United States, for example, Mexico or Canada, we have, the Marshal Service has a field office in Mexico, so we would deal directly with them, right? If it's in Canada, We have a great relationship with the Canadian authorities, okay? Toronto Fugitive Unit, the RCMPs, and so on. So, depending on what direction
I can tell you, being Canadian, honestly, John, that the cultural differences, if he's off to Canada, will not even be a whiff. It won't be an issue at all. But that's a great question, you know, for you, Joel Lambert, and that is that if you do decide to go to somewhere, maybe not Canada, which is pretty easy, but maybe Mexico, which is a different language, and it is different money, and it's a whole different culture. How does the metric change if he heads south of the border?
Well, the issues that he's going to deal with are what you just brought up, Ashley. I mean, you have a money issue, you have a language issue, which Spanish, Mexico, I mean, there's a lot of gringos down there, so it wouldn't be as, he wouldn't stick out as much, but a lot of places, you'll be an obvious foreigner, and you'll be suspected. You'll be suspicious. You won't be blending into the culture there. And then the cultural differences are the biggest one, because most places have different cultural norms and mores, and most people don't know those unless he's had a chance to do research before he goes there or is intimately familiar with the culture he's trying to blend into. If he's trying to hide out someplace that he's not very familiar with, cultural mores will trip somebody up pretty quickly.
So just on that same vein for a second there, Joel, I got to ask you, if in fact he gets caught by the federales or maybe anybody south of the border, he could be in Central South America, generally speaking, do they treat you gently as you are, say, awaiting extradition back to the good old United States of America?
Well, I'll just put it this way. If I couldn't be in a Norwegian or Swedish prison, I'd want to be in an American prison, because most of the other prisons around the world are not up to the standard that we have here.
Kind of what I thought you were going to say. No, I remember Joran Vandersloot is sitting in a prison in South America that is just horrendous. I mean, the conditions are not where I'd want to spend a nickel of my time. Okay, Chuck Jordan, first of all, the international bounty hunting business, I kind of knew it existed. I just don't know the extent of it. Is it big business? And do we already have legions of people like you sniffing out a potential Brian Laundrie catch?
Well, the majority of our members are domestic. We do have international members, And we work off of the Rewards for Justice program, which is administered by the U.S. State Department. They have a list of fugitives. Most of them are wanted terrorists, war crimes, genocide, drug trafficking, that sort of thing. And the rewards are, tend to be upwards of $5 million. So there's a huge financial incentive.
Yeah, I would think that a guy who's wanted right now for bank fraud wouldn't really even be on the radar of anybody. But, John Coffey, it's still a good question. When does someone like Brian Laundry, who's an emerging potential target for not only marshals but bounty hunters or Interpol, when does that get on their radar? How serious does it have to be? How big a deal does it have to be?
Well, he's certainly on the radar now, and he has been for the past month or so. What he has to worry about, this guy is, assuming he's alive, he's going to be sleeping with one eye open. He's going to be mentally fatigued. Even though he does have survival skills, as what was reported, you have a mental stress factor here that he's going to be wondering how close the bounty hunters or the law enforcement authorities are to him. So wherever he is, he's going to have a need to access a source of information, whether it's a satellite radio, whether it's someone in the community or whatever. And that's why it's important for if he's not in the wilderness or even if he is in the wilderness, for vigilance on behalf of the public to report any sighting right away and let law enforcement determine the validity of the sighting.
Okay, John, Joel, and Chuck, hold your thoughts for a second. When we come back after the break, I have a very important question about the importance of being wealthy, smart, connected, and supported with really good parents when it comes to being on the run and staying on the run. We're back right after this with this incredible team. Welcome back. I've got this fantastic panel of just international experts of what it takes to find people if they decide to flee the country. And with the three of you here, I wanted to remind our viewers of a couple of cases that really had us understanding what it took to get people back when they flee. Andrew Luster was the heir to the Max Factor fortune. He fled to Mexico during his 2003 rape trial. He drugged three women with GHB. He was arrested 5 months later in Puerto Vallarta. He'd been convicted in absentia, was sentenced to 50 years in prison. But again, Max Factor means he had some money. Alex Kelly was known as the preppy rapist from Darien, Connecticut. Somewhere I know familiar. I'm pretty familiar with it. He fled to Europe with the help of his well-off parents to avoid standing trial on raping two teenage girls back in 86. Surrendered in Switzerland, convicted in 97, sentenced to 16 years. The similarity of those two cases, Joel Lambert, is that these people had money, lots of it. They had a support network and, when it comes to taking off and being in unfamiliar terrain, money has to help, right, Joel?
Money makes everything easier. Money, as far as assets, as far as survival, as far as, finding a place to live. I mean, cash talks. What someone couldn't do through ordinary means, a big pile of green can grease some wheels very easily.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian Laundrie's parents don't seem to have a whole lot of money. They live in a pretty modest little yellow bungalow in Northport, Florida. Their company, as I understand it, is a juice servicing company. They're not captains of industry. But Chuck Jordan, they are pretty committed to staying tight-lipped. And one of the other familiar issues with Alex Kelly, the preppy rapist, and with the Max Factor heir is that they had parents that were supportive. Does it all start and end with parents in a case like this?
Well, I think in this particular case, you may be, on the right track with that. It's obvious that, after Gabby Petito, was murdered, that Brian Laundry didn't take off in just any direction. He went home with his parents. And he had a few weeks to plan his life as a fugitive. That, I think, is a good indication that time was well spent putting together a plan, for his life as a fugitive, perhaps gathering some financial resources, reaching out to perhaps, his outer circle, maybe a friend or relative that might be able to, you know, put him up and sort of help him keep a low profile.
Yeah, good point. Like John Cuff, the fact that this is a COVID era, does that make it harder just to skip town, skip the country and get into another country?
Well, certainly internationally, that's a big obstacle. The other thing, too, just to change your identity, to acquire new identity, false identity and things like that, that's going to be very difficult. So that's why I'm hedging my bets that if he's alive, he's hunkered down over here. He could be in a concrete jungle somewhere, in a hole up in a safe house somewhere. You know, as we know, that vehicle was sitting out in that reservation out there. You know, law enforcement's doing a fantastic job down there in that search, and especially under those treacherous conditions. And now whether he got picked up there and brought somewhere else, obviously we don't know. That's a $1 million question. But he's still going to need support.
Amen to that. He's going to need support. So to that end, Joel Lambert, play me out. Do you think he could stay hidden forever? I've got about 40 seconds. Take me away.
I don't think so. I think that, like the other guys are saying, a good deception trail. He had time to plan it. He could have dropped his car off there, brought all the assets and put all indications that he's in that reserve and pull all the attention there while he moves someplace else and diddy mouths off to his secondary plan or what his primary plan was. I don't think that I don't think he's out there on his own surviving this long without help, and he's still alive and he's still, you know, completely functional. I don't think that's a realistic scenario at this point.
Joel Lambert, can't thank you enough. John Cuff, thank you as well. Chuck Jordan, just great information from the three of you. Appreciate it. I want to remind our viewers that if you see something, you say something. The FBI's tip line is 1-800-CALL-FBI. That's 1-800-225-5324. You can be a part of this. Everybody has a part in this. Thank you for being a part of this program. We will be back tomorrow with more on this particular story. See you then.